Okay, members, I'd like to call the meeting to order. Please silence all electronic devices. Ms. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Angolia.
Here.
Vice Chair Drake. Republican Committee Will McFarland.
Here.
Ranking Democratic Member Silvers.
Here.
Representatives Barnaby.
Here.
Clemens.
Here.
Daly.
Here.
DeSegley.
Here.
Fabricio.
Here.
Geller is excused. Haig is excused. Jenny.
Here.
Latvala.
Here.
Maggard.
Here and McClure. Happy to be here.
McClure.
Here.
Nixon is excused. Umphrey.
Here.
Plakin is excused. Placencia. Roma.
Here.
Schoaf.
Here.
Thompson.
Here.
Tomko.
Here.
Will Height.
Let the record reflect that a quorum is present. Members, before we start, we just want to wish a very happy 65th birthday to Rep. Rommel. Happy 65th there, sir. That number is accurate, right?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman, and I'll be collecting Social Security soon, so thanks. There you go.
Okay, good morning, members. Each session, our committee often hears bills related to building permitting processes, building and development, and impact fees. Many of you have heard from your constituents about issues, or you may have encountered issues yourself relating to delays in obtaining building permits for certain developments. I have invited local government school district officials, developers, and attorneys here today to discuss ideas for improving and streamlining the permit process specifically related to school concurrency. To start our panel discussion, each panelist will introduce themselves, describe their knowledge of the process, including any issues they have encountered, and any ideas that they have for the committee to consider. After we do the introduction or have them introduce themselves, there may be some just natural questions. And at that point, I want the members to just ask me. We'll recognize you for questions. The purpose here is to have to get a better understanding of the fundamentals of school concurrency, the issues that school districts and counties are having when as it comes to school concurrency, and the issues that developers and builders are having with school concurrency. At the end, hopefully have a better understanding of what we can put forth in terms of or consider as a work product that will streamline this process so we can have the stations that we need for their students. We're not putting any undue burden on the school districts and any undue burden on the developers who are building the houses. So with that, first up, we have Mr. Tim Forson from St. John's County School District. He's going to give a little background information about school concurrency, and in addition, give us his experience with school concurrency and ideas for streamlining the process. Mr. Forson, you are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the opportunity to be here and to share with you today. I'm Tim Forson, Superintendent of St. John's County Schools. St. John's County Schools are located just below Jacksonville, just below Duval. It is the county immediately south of Duval County, and it is a very fast-growing school district, has been for a number of years, and continues to be that way. So I think one of the things that we realize as school systems, and I was a deputy superintendent at the time school concurrency came forward in school systems. We were part of six districts that were part of a pilot in the development of models that might be able to work, given the statutory requirements that came forward. And so we've been a part of it like every other district since 2008, and we've been a growing district throughout that entire time. And so school concurrency for us is a review process to ensure that the necessary infrastructure is in place at the same time that the development begins to impact the community. And so it's a process that ensures that we are working on infrastructure as a school system at the same time a project or a development may be doing so as well. So it is a school concurrency for St. John's is a multi-step project review. And first, the proposed development is reviewed to create a projected number of students at each level, elementary, middle, and high. And it's based on student generation rates. So we run generation rates to know, well, how many children are actually per household, whether that's per single family household, multifamily household, or even mobile home. So we kind of categorize it in that way. Next, we determine if in which school concurrency area the project's located. So we first look to see what that project is, locate it in our district where it is in a CSA or concurrency service area. And for St. John's, there are six concurrency service areas, and they're all based on, there were six high schools at the time we came forward with the plan and the program. And so we've maintained those boundaries of six boundaries across the county. And St. John's is about a little over 600 square miles, just to give you an idea of that. The concurrency service area that the project is then evaluated to see if adequate school capacity to support that development exists or will be in place within 3 years. And so it is a place in which we're looking to see, do we have it, or in our plans, in our short-term plans, will school construction or expansion exist that allow those seats to be in place? If there's no capacity in the school, in the current concurrency service area that this project is in, then you look to the adjacent CSAs. And if there is capacity in those that are bordering that concurrency service area, they are utilized by the project and able to be a part of allowing that project to move forward based on capacity. So if it's not available, then the developer decides whether or not to delay the project. If they're looking at what point will there be seats in St. John's County in this part of the county, or they'll enter into a proportionate share mitigation agreement with both the district and the county. And we do that together as we work through that. We utilize student generation rates for each concurrency area to project the number of students that are going to be generated by the project. These rates take into consideration the number of existing students and the type of housing, as I mentioned before, being constructed in each concurrency service area. We actually deduct charter students from that calculation and only project based on traditional attendance-zoned public school students that are part of that plan. In St. John's County, we implement school concurrency with the six concurrency service areas, as I mentioned, and given the size and the diversity of the county, implementing it district-wide would be detrimental in our high-growth areas. Utilizing capacity in less populated areas of the county could result in long travel times for students who have to be placed where those seats are, or by consistent or frequent changing of attendance zones as you push out one group of students in a nearby school and push them closer to another. So there are kind of two steps in that could happen. If the developer decides to enter into a proportionate share mitigation agreement, we've developed a model. That model actually sits on our website, so it's very transparent. Any builder or developer can look at it at any time. They can plug in their data and see what that would play out to be according to what the capacity is at any given time. And this model takes into consideration appropriate credits and allows a uniform and predictable mitigation system. So from the side of me building and developing, it allows me to have prediction and know comfortably what direction it might be headed in. Since the beginning of school concurrency in 2008, St. John's County School District has grown by more than 19,000 students, about 67%. So we've been at a very fast rate. We opened two new schools last year. We'll open up another high school this year. So it is about a school a year that we're working under. And because of that, capacity changes rapidly as well. So it does impact it as we go forward. This year, our student population, if you look at where we are now, it's doubled since 2004. And we're currently at about 48,000 students in St. John's County. And this year we experienced a 7.2% growth rate, but typically we're at about a 4% growth rate. Part of that was probably last year and it being down to a 2. So there's probably some backlog of growth, families moving into the system. So we've seen a great increase at a very fast period of time. So that's kind of generally how it works for us. It's worked very, very well, I believe. Very few situations have we had where a developer or a project holds or delays. In most cases, we sit down, work through the mitigation process, and then proceed they proceed forward with that project. That's kind of an overview, quick overview.
Mr. Forsen, first of all, thank you for that. There are about a good dozen questions I want to ask you, but we're going to hold off until we get to hear from all the other panelists. In no particular order. Let's go to Angela Usher, the Assistant Superintendent for Polk County Schools. You are recognized.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for Polk County Public Schools, or Facilities and Operation. Facilities planning is one of the departments, and school concurrency falls under that department. In 2008, school concurrency was implemented in Polk County under the mandatory provision of 2005. The level of service was established at 100%, and the CSAs were based on the elementary, middle, and high school boundaries. So we had several CSAs since it was consistent with the boundaries. There are 15 municipalities, the school board, and county party to that agreement. We're fortunate in Polk that the sales tax was renewed. It was implemented in 2003 for 15 years and renewed in 2018. So we do have funds from that to maintain our schools and to modernize. Our three major funding sources to keep up with growth would be the impact fees and the millage and the sales tax. I must say on the school concurrency, no one has ever had to mitigate. And the reason for this is, I believe, due to the adjacency provision and looking for capacity in the adjacent CSA if there's not capacity in the CSA serving that development. Cons to that is that you switch you look for capacity in other CSAs and away from where the impact is. And when that development is built, the students attending the schools will then be shifted off an attendance boundary and to the new school. And in addition to adjacency, you also have to account the issued construction within the first 3 years of the plan. In 2017, we came close to mitigation. The developer had entered into the 90-day negotiation period, but we did add a middle school to the plan, and so the developer did not have to mitigate. Again, as you all know, concurrency is not to stop development. It's a timing issue and working together. And concurrency is only the regular part of that statute. The interlocal agreement is so much more important with the coordination for shared use, cost of infrastructure, population projection. So the regular part is based on the multipliers at the different levels, even though when we're doing our planning, we know that some areas have a higher multiplier than other areas. So we take that into account when we're doing our projections. In the interlocal agreement, it also requires that we meet regularly with the planners from the cities, which we do, to share development review information. And even though a developer might come in with 1,000 units, we look at the build-out factor and distribute those units because they all won't come in, because then we'll have what they call as ghost students. So we're looking at all that. We have a good relationship with the other cities and the county in planning for growth. And we update our capital plan every year. We look at our projections, we validate it against actual and against the state's projection. I want to go back a little bit, though, to my previous employment. In 1990, I was hired by Palm Beach County to administer the regular concurrency process, water, sewer, drainage, traffic, and all that. Two of the elected officials were very concerned that schools were not included as one of the concurrency services required, so they started working on that and formed a committee. I left the county and went to a city, and then the school board hired me under the facilities planning and the real estate department. We did implement, Palm Beach County implemented concurrency under the optional requirement in 2002. Because the schools were so overcrowded, we were short like 60,000 plus seats. We implemented with a staggered level of service. We worked with the developers, so some level of service were at 170%. So that we did not stop development while we built. We used COPS, impact fees, and whatever funding source was available. We built 35 new schools and modernized 47. Added about 60,000 new seats, and we brought the level of service down to 110%. Sometimes it went to 120%. We also had a school concurrency oversight committee with a demographer on that committee that looked at our projections, and they were able to approve schools going to 120%. Back again in Palm Beach County, the interlocal expired in about 2008, 2009. So we had meetings with our school board members, government officials, and talked about the pros and cons of school concurrency. Even though we approved between that time frame, that 8 years, over 100,000 units, in Palm Beach County, no one had to mitigate either, again, because of the adjacency. So the I don't want to say the honesty. It was up to the school district to make sure that we have enough capacity in the capital plan to match the projected enrollment. So that was really difficult, and we looked at every funding source. We also talked about the impact and the problems with adjacency. So the elected official asked staff to look at concurrency and come up with an alternative process. The city staff, county staff, and school district staff came up with a process called SCAD, School Capacity Adequate Determination. This process, you look at the schools directly serving the development. And if those schools don't have capacity, then a letter is sent out to the local government. The schools serving the development don't have capacity. The thing is, though, that letter is not binding because it's not under concurrency. Palm Beach County sees having school concurrency in about 2012, 2013. So they, even though they were one of the first ones to implement it in 2002, they're no longer concurrency. So we still review development. We still coordinate with Palm Beach County and with Polk. Palm Beach County still coordinates with the schools and with the local government staff. And then it is up to the elected official then to say, okay, school district staff says there's no capacity. Developer, go talk to the school district and see how you could fix this. Do you have a school site that you can give them? There's no capacity immediately where your development will impact. So that's the way it is in Palm Beach County. But back to Polk County, I am proud to say that we have been working well. The good thing was the forward thinking in Polk County. We own quite a number of land bank sites in the areas where we knew the growth was occurring. So now when we have a need for a school, we don't have that lag time to try to acquire a site. We update our capital plan. We do have a little bit more capacity than enrollment, but as you know, Polk County is growing quite rapidly, especially in the Northeast area. So already we have schools in the plan in 22, 23 to make sure that we have them in place to meet the growth. The county, the school board is still concerned about us being able to keep pace with development. And so they have asked for a summit to talk with the county government and the cities to see what steps we have to take to make sure that we have adequate capacity for when the development impact comes.
Thank you. All right, moving around, let's go to Michael Cimento, managing partner at Cimento Law. You're recognized.
Thank you. Again, my name is Michael Cimento. I'm from Flagler County, Palm Coast, Florida. I am a member of the Flagler County Home Builders Association. For our firm has been for probably 30 years. And so I was a civil engineer and became an attorney for about 20 years. Our firm represented the Flagler County School District and was part of the school district when concurrency became an issue in Florida, and the DCA put forth the interlocal agreements between counties and school districts to manage this. So my experience from the school board's perspective is relevant. Also, I represent numerous developers and home builders in the region of Volusia, Flagler County, and some in St. John. So I'm very familiar with the process and the issues facing both sides, and it is an issue that, and that's why we're here. Our issue in our region is we have very diverse communities. St. John's County, you heard, is growing rapidly with families, with schools on one a year. Flagler County, on the other hand, is an aging population. It, in the last 5 years, it grew. It aged from about 48 to 53 years old. Our data, when we hired our expert, revealed that over the past 12 years, there were about 9,800 building permits pulled, and there was roughly about 200 students. Yet, the school district continued to collect impact fees, and as of today, has roughly $30 million sitting in impact fees collected to be used for schools or other like things. So where we're at right now in our community is the school district had updated their impact fee, and despite the legislature allowing it to go up in the 50% increment. They elected to almost double it, and they found exceptional circumstances based upon, if I recall, inflation only. So they elected to double it almost, and they went to the county commission. And the county commission, listening to the home builders in the development community and sitting as the point person board to finalize this impact fee and the mitigation, they asked that we evaluate each other's numbers. So that's where we're at right now. However, one of the things we do have in our district is that the under the our interlocal agreement, you go get a preliminary plat and you go out to develop your lots. And before you do that, you need to go get your letter from the school district about capacity, as you've heard. Well, our school district has elected to not issue those letters right now. So in de facto purposes, have suggested to our community that there would be a moratorium, not on homes being built, because those homes are already vested, but the creation of new lots and new developments. We can't get those letters of capacity reservations from our school district. So that happened within the last 60 days. So we're trying to work it out as a community. The other thing that happens in our district is we have different mitigation models and how developers have to pay and when they have to pay. So it's very inconsistent. We had a project that was on their CIP recently that was for a 20,000 square foot building for 300 students. And the estimated cost they had was about $18 million. So we're trying to figure out how we're growing and how to pay for it. But there, from our perspective, from the developer and home builder side, there's just great inconsistency, unpredictability. I've represented developers for now pushing 30 years, both as an engineer. And I would tell you, generally speaking, developers understand that impact fees are here to stay. They're paid for roads and sewer and water, so we can build those into the models. But it's the unpredictability of how much and when they're paid that is frustrating to the capital and the investment into our communities to build shopping centers, roads, and communities. So we're looking and we're trying to work with our school district in the county. We're having summits. It's a difficult process because they have their needs. Generally speaking, in our community, we have very different ideas about how we're growing and if we're growing and the costs associated with planning into the future and whether it'll be necessary. So, you know, we come here today to kind of help you understand what our community is dealing with and the fear of moratoriums, I guess is the right way to say it, even though they're not specifically moratoriums. But by not issuing these letters, local governments are supposed to be prohibited from issuing plats and preliminary development orders. So those are things that we're struggling with today. I don't think there's one size that fits all. Again, as you heard, St. John's County, they're one school a year. Our community hasn't built a school since 2012, and now all of a sudden we had a new superintendent and the model changed, and now there's $175 million in capital improvements that the school district needs, despite the fact that we haven't had much more than about 200 students over the last 10 years. So I think there's unpredictability in the statute and the model, and it gives great leeway to jurisdictions on how they handle it, and I think that's some of the frustrations that you may hear from your constituents both on both sides. I'll pause there.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Willie Nunn, President of Homes by West Bay.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. So my name is Willie Nunn. I'm the president of Homes by West Bay. We founded our company in 2009, and this year we'll close approximately 950 homes. That makes us the third largest builder in the Tampa Bay area, and we're the largest private builder. We also do a fair amount of development, and we're also active primarily in the Tampa Bay area, extending from Manatee, Polk, Hillsborough, and Pasco County. We also have a second company, Casa Fresca Homes, which builds a more affordable product, and we're one of the issues that I think we're going to need to address as well is affordability and how it ties into a lot of what's going on. I have roughly 35 years of experience in the finance, construction, and development of residential projects. I've been the president of the Tampa Bay Builders Association, and in that capacity, and as governmental affairs chair, have supported a number of impact fee increases through the years, as well as a proposed referendum for funding schools. Over my career, have worked with municipalities and school board to offer school sites as potential mitigation and increasing capacity. I think in the counties, particularly in Hillsborough, where we operate, both the school board and the county gets a fair notice of what's coming through both zonings and the preliminary site plan process, and should have ample opportunity to plan for the growth as it's coming. One of my fundamental problems with the concurrency system as it's implemented is it's essentially a one-day test for, in many cases, potentially a five-year project. And this really is a mismatch and doesn't really make a lot of sense. And considering especially that we're trying to solve a Rubik's Cube for capacity on three different levels at the same time, elementary, middle, and high school, if we're in a problem area, it is essentially virtually impossible for us as private developers to solve this without willing partners on the government side. So I think that how we go about addressing the problem, and I look forward to getting into discussion about this, but how we go about addressing this model, which has become increasingly antiquated, is important. I would sort of end with my perspective a little bit on what's happening in Florida. The portability of work, or working from home as we know it now, is the biggest shift in our society that's going to affect the growth of Florida since air conditioning. So we've got the same tax policy, the same mild winters, and the same great lifestyle. The only thing that's been preventing some people from moving here is their job. Now it's not important anymore to be officed in San Francisco or in New York. And we're seeing the number of our out-of-state buyers triple. And in general, our business has exploded over the last 2 years. And I think that there's an acute urgency with this problem. It's showing up in the price of homes. We've seen appreciation of anywhere from 25 to 40% in the base price of homes in our metro area. And, this needs to be addressed. And in other words, we're going to have to build more homes and deliver more infrastructure, or we're going to be facing some really big problems really quickly.
Thank you, sir. Ms. Cammy Corbett, shareholder at Hill, Ward, and Henderson. You are recognized.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Cammy Corbett. I'm a shareholder at the law firm of Hill, Ward, and Henderson, and I represent developers, but I also represent school boards. And this is a really dense topic, and you'll see you've heard in everyone's comments, there's an overlap between impact fees, which is really a separate statute altogether, and concurrency. And the concept of concurrency is that the infrastructure will be there at the time the development occurs. That's easy with roads and with utilities, right? Is the road wide enough? There's not a lot of subjective policy decision-making that goes on determining how and when we build roads and how when we build utilities. However, school concurrency is very complicated, as you heard. And in 2005 and 2006, when this was first implemented, there was a very lengthy statute that appeared to set forth a framework for what exactly every county and city needed to do to implement school concurrency. One of the best articles I've read on this that broke it down into plain English was a 2006 article by Ann Gibson, who was an assistant county attorney at Polk County at the time. And it's a Florida Bar article called Implementing School Concurrency, The Challenges of Adopting a United Vision. And that title, it says it all. What is the united vision? So what the statute really did, and as she says in her article, builds a solid skeletal form as to how this is supposed to operate. We're supposed to look at student generation, where is the project located, concurrency service areas. Those policy decisions that were being made by the school board and by the Board of County Commissioners and cities and counties are the muscular system that really is the way we implement school concurrency. And you have heard today already, there are multiple, there is as many ways to do this as there you could possibly think of. Some are doing it at a preliminary plat. I mean, just the concept of how do you calculate student generation, I would submit to you that's probably not uniform statewide. Probably different counties and cities. And some of that might make sense because more rural counties. But ultimately, if a house generates students, one single family home, why wouldn't that be more uniform? What are the concurrency service boundaries? Those are all localized decisions. And it really was, I think, intended when it was passed to be a tri-party agreement, really, between the builders and developers who were going to pay their impact fees or pay their proportionate share, the Board of County Commissioners, and the school boards. And the Board of County Commissioners and the school boards were supposed to work together with their interlocal agreements, which they all have interlocal agreements, not necessarily all following those interlocal agreements, but they all exist. And so what happens when one of those two governmental entities, whether it's a school district in a particular area or a Board of County Commissioners in our particular area, decides my interests are no longer aligned with making sure schools are built to make sure homes can be built, and therefore I'm not going to participate and I'm not going to try my best to have this united vision of how we accomplish school concurrency. And that's what, you know, that's where it breaks down, and I think that's one of the areas where we're having difficulty as on the development side is we're here to pay our money, whether it be our impact fee, if that covers it, or if we're in a capacity deficiency to pay our proportionate share, but we can't build the schools. We can't decide where they're located. We can't decide which of the governmental entities are going to build the mobility infrastructure. We pay mobility fees, so we're paying into new road infrastructure as well, and we're finding ourselves in a sort of a food fight between the two local governments who can't figure out and can't solve how to have a united vision, and that's one of the difficulties we're having.
Thank you. Next up, the Honorable Lee Constantine, Commissioner, Seminole County. Senator, you are recognized.
Members of the committee, it's always a pleasure to come back home to the House, spend 8 years here, 10 years in the Senate. I was chairman of the Senate Education Committee, so I have a little bit of knowledge about this issue, although it was back in the 2000s. I also was on the House and the Senate Appropriations Education Committee all the years I was been in the legislature, all 18 years. I will tell you that I am proud to represent Seminole County, and I'm proud to represent the Association of Counties. I'm going to be incoming president next year. And as one of the speakers has already indicated, one size does not fit all. Seminole County is the third most densely populated county in the state, but it's also one of the smallest in geographic area. We are one of five A-rated school districts. And one of the things that we take a great deal of pride in is that our education system, our school district, is the greatest economic driver of Seminole County. People in the Central Florida area want to live in Seminole County. Young parents want to live in Seminole County because of the school district. So we take great pride in ensuring that our school district is, in working in unison with the county and with the seven very diverse cities of Seminole County. The one thing that I would continue to push is the fact that the cities, the county, and the school districts have to work together if anything is going to work for both development as well as the children. Parents do not want to buy in an area and then find out that they have to send their child, especially elementary, to schools where they pass two or three other elementary schools. And it is important that you find a way to keep those children in the area. Small schools, neighborhood schools, are one of the greatest indicators of success of children. And we have already seen in the last election cycle how parents are taking a greater role and a greater interest in what happens to their children. So whatever you're doing here in looking at concurrency, keep in mind that, yes, we want to accommodate development. Yes, we want to work with the school districts and the cities and the counties. Most importantly, we want to make sure that those parents that are buying homes in certain districts are going to hopefully get their child in that elementary school, middle school, or high school district. School rezoning is a messy process, one that is expensive, contentious, time-consuming, and the more you require it to happen, the worse it will be for the students and the parents. So I will tell you very much that what we've done in Seminole County is worked very closely with the school district, with the seven cities, to come up with an interlocal agreement. That interlocal agreement does define smaller concurrency service areas. However, we also, if it's in capacity, we look at the adjoining concurrency services areas. And if there's no, only then, if there's no capacity, would we have any mitigation from developers other than what they have already do. And the fact of the matter is, we have never, in the 9 years I've been a county commissioner, have ever had to ask for mitigation from developers, because we work so closely with them on the attendance zones and with the capacity, so that especially, again, I repeat, and I want to reemphasize this over and over again, it is so important to keep those elementary school children in their neighborhoods and not have them bus or move to the second or the third or the fourth school down the road.
Thank you, sir. And panelists, I just want to thank you again in advance for coming and taking your time. I'm going to ask a couple questions here, and then I encourage the members of the committee to hop in and ask any questions that they have also. But just to start off, so Mr. Forson, you had said that a couple of things that I honed in on. It sounds like you have a pretty good handle on how to deal with concurrency, so much that you've made it very open and transparent and put it on the website where it becomes, and I think your word was predictable. So the first question I have for you, and I thank you for that, is it's my understanding that many school districts / counties are not, and this, I'm going to open this also to Mr. Cimento also and Ms. Corbett, because you may be able to weigh in on this, is that school concurrency isn't often predictable, it's negotiable. At that point, would that be an accurate statement? Yes, sir.
I think there's probably a yes and no to that a little bit, because we have a model, but within that model, there are several ways that as a developer, I can get credit that will help to, if there's not capacity, to reduce maybe my capital cost to move forward. And so that level of negotiation, and I think it was said earlier. So one of the more important things, like for us at this point, is sites, school sites. So it's really important for us. We need to have conversations with developers as they come forward about availability of school sites, because if we continue to go at the pace we're going, that's going to be a critical part of St. John's in the next 10 years, is having the location. So when we go to the point of sitting and discussing, negotiating, it may be points in times where a developer would bring forward multiple school sites, which would then offset a mitigation cost. So that's probably a common way of doing that. And then the other piece of it is, it's not. There's not a high level of negotiation, because it is a model that they see has the elements that I hope feel make it fair. I'm like anyone else. I don't want to pay more than I have to pay to do what I need to do to move forward. But I, you know, our developers, our builders, they are very committed to the quality of life, just like we are. And so that ability to come to the table and have those conversations has been very helpful. So I think over time, there's not as much negotiation and it's more clarity about what it would cost me to move forward with a project in St. John's than it was prior to school concurrency. There was a lot of negotiation, a lot of bartering back and forth about, well, what do you really need and what can we really do to come to an agreement to move forward with a school?
Thank you, sir. For a question for either Ms. Corbett or Mr. Cimento or both. Have you seen in your experience where school districts / governing bodies are holding developers basically hostage to the process, even though there is a school concurrency, even if they have a school concurrency plan, they're holding the developers hostage, for the lack of a better word, from approval for a certain development to try to extract as much as possible out of the developer?
I was going to respond to, Mr. Chair, to your prior question about transparency and how do we know whether there's concurrency available or not. And I would just speak to that and go back to Mr. Nunn's comments about, he kind of said it in shorthand, but he said whether or not there's capacity, at least in Hillsborough County, is based on a count that occurs at one point in the year. And how many students are in the school in October of each year determines capacity for the entire year. And the school boards are the keeper of that data. We don't have any independent way to verify the data that the school board is relying upon, which is different than, for example, going back to the analogy with road impact fees or traffic generation. We have a published standard ITE trip generation. We can hire an independent traffic study consultant. He can review it. Maybe he can do traffic counts and he can make a determination. We don't, on the development side, we don't have any way to verify the data that's out there. And then as far as holding hostage, that goes back to my original point of we're in a situation in Hillsborough County where the local governments are not able to work together to approve school sites. The school board is saying, if we raised our impact fees, if you pay your impact fees, we'll have adequate money to buy to build the school. But the county is saying, well, we're not sure if you can have that school site there because you need to do $20 million of road infrastructure. And we are being held hostage in that negotiation between those two local governments. And, you know, I think while there's some transparency in things that are posted on a website, we just don't have the information available to us on a regular basis to understand and independently verify what we're being told.
Mr. Cimento, do you want to weigh in?
Certainly. I mirror her comments about transparency, yes, but accuracy is very difficult for our side of the table, as she explained. As far as holding hostage, I wouldn't want to say that any one member at the school district that we deal with is holding us hostage. I think the unintended consequence is that our side of the table feels that way, and it's part of the process. So if you're familiar with what we do, we go and we get approvals and we design the whole thing and then we get it approved by the local government. And before we can start getting our permit and turning dirt, we have to go to the school district and get this letter that says you're good to go. When we get to that point, we already have millions of dollars invested in the situation. And if we disagree, there's no opportunity. So we feel that we're held hostage. Now, the other things that we don't have is the information to challenge. And if we do challenge, how do we challenge it without stopping our project? So our side of the table does feel that we are held hostage many times, that we come to the table and we say, oh, you owe a $750,000 payment next month before you get started. And we look around and go, what? And how do we get that? But we don't have the time because capital, you understand that. So, yeah, and in our district, we have had a letter from our school district that said they will not be issuing concurrency letters until their issues with the county are resolved. And until that has happened, our local jurisdictions, our counties and cities won't issue development orders for plats. So we are being held hostage. Yes, sir.
Mr. Nunn.
Just one add-on. We can get the information for what the enrollment might be for that one day of the year, for that one day test. But, and you can observe, theoretically, you can observe capacity, but you don't know who else has been promised that capacity through the approval process. So in that sense, it's extremely opaque, and we're, as has been mentioned, you know, we're at a significant information disadvantage when it comes to trying to resolve the problem. And, you know, back to my introductory remarks, I mean, this is, you know, the school board and the counties together, they have the tools and knowledge that we don't. And that, so it's very difficult for us to be, you know, properly engaged in the process. I mean, the money's there. We pay the money. We just suggest that the process needs to be smoothed out, and perhaps, it's difficult to continue to rely on what is inherently a people and personality process. We can point to jurisdictions, and some of them are represented here, that this works pretty well. And in Pasco County, where we operate, works quite well. The school board thinks ahead, obtains the sites from the large developments, and this isn't a discussion there. And we believe there's we foresee adequate capacity into the future in all the projects that we're involved in. Hillsborough is another matter.
Good points, and it was also very poignant, the point that you made about it being a snapshot in time. Question for the whole panel. When determining school capacity or school needs, I know that Mr. Forson said that you take into account charter schools. That's not written in statute. That's something that you do as best practices. Is this something from everyone's experience? Do you see other counties doing that best practice where they are taking into account charter schools? Because if they're not, then they're just by sheer math, they're overestimating the amount of the need for the student population for expansion of the desk.
In the present one that I'm working on in Flagler County, it is different than St. John's County. We have a little different problem that there are 13,000 built lots from back in the 70s and 80s. And so our school district is concerned with reservations, things that are reserved. So they take into consider what they believe to be reservations. So our numbers are incredibly different and lower than the school district's number about growth and how they have to accommodate growth. And I'll give you an example. I did a project that was about 7,000 acres, 5,000 units, and it started in 2006. And because of the recession, we have just hit about the 300th home in that subdivision. And the school district reserves capacity for 2,500 units in that, which we were vested on. But they've been reserving that capacity for roughly 12 years under their model. So the model is a little bit different in this jurisdiction than St. John's County. My experience in St. John's County is, yes, it is predictable. You go in and you fill out the form and you pay. That is predictable. But the amount that you pay is sometimes a heartburn. I had a client that said at the end of the day he was paying about $21,000 a unit in mitigation and impact fees to St. John's County School District, but doesn't have the ability to sit down and figure that out. Now, I don't have the specifics behind that because that was anecdotal from a client of mine telling me that. But these are the problems that we're having.
So a question for anybody on the panel, you can weigh in on this. So we were talking about, go ahead, Ms. Usher.
In our projections, we do take into account charter schools, and we do it by specific areas, and if we know new ones are coming in, but we have to keep in the back of our mind if that charter school should close, we still have to plan for additional capacity. So we do incorporate that information. But the thing is, another thing he mentioned, that some district put all the students in right away. There's certain capacity for build-out, so you should kind of do a projection instead of putting all your students in when that development comes in. If it's for 1,000 units, it won't all build out next year. So you can use that student generation for that school over like a 5-year trend, then putting all those students, because then you will have ghost students.
So the question I have for anybody on the panel, so piggybacking also on, I think it was Mr. Forson's comments, or actually may have been yours, Ms. Usher, about six different, your county's having six different concurrency areas. And the adjacency issue where they will take into account. So what we're talking about here is best practices, right? We're talking about charter schools accounting for charter schools because that just makes sense that if there's going to, if you're having X amount of charter schools come online in the next 5 years, you should maybe not 100% to your point, Ms. Usher, but there should be some sort of accounting for that additional capacity. That's just common sense best practices. But it would also seem to me that if you have like six concurrency areas and you're talking about adjacency where, you know, if you move the concurrency area or the boundary lines east or west or north or south, you can relieve some of the concurrency in that area by making it at least flexible. Are we seeing school districts that are not being flexible with these concurrency areas? Are they being rigid to the fact where, you know, you may have a couple of blocks, maybe a half a mile, where if you moved or shifted something over a half a mile, it wouldn't be that much of a burden on the school population, but the district, or probably more importantly, the governing body is being inflexible with moving it and then thus putting a bigger burden on the developer to deliver the development because they are being inflexible.
You know, in Hillsborough, I'd offer that we're essentially tapped out on the growth areas and the areas that are adjacent to the school zones that would be adjacent to the growth areas. However, on the other hand, we have not really innovated a whole lot in how, you know, how we might manage capacity. Obviously, there's boundaries, but just reinvesting in existing sites. A lot of the existing sites, you know, might not be, you know, developed to their full capacity in terms of the actual school plant there. And, you know, I'd like to see that, you know, be more actively considered. But, you know, another thing is, you know, we see the charter schools draining middle school and creating middle school capacity. So all the time. And, you know, there's some, you know, educators will argue about the success or viability of middle school in general, but what I'm observing is there's middle school capacity. And why not, you know, move some kids from high school into middle schools and you know, reallocate along those lines. Move more flexibly than just there's three levels of schools and you have to have concurrency at all three levels. That's fairly inflexible.
I have a bunch more questions. I'm going to ask one question on this particular issue, and then if there are any questions from the members, just let me know. More than happy to get you in to answer those questions before I go back to mine. So in the opinion, any panelists want to weigh in, do you think it's better to have concurrency than on a district-wide basis? Or do you, in your opinion, is it better to have concurrency on a specific area basis, or a boundary basis?
Mr. Chairman, if I could, you know, I'm the one, Senator, that gets the information, both from the school, the counties, the information from the school district, get the requests from the developers as to what they want to do. And as I said, in the 9 years that I've been a county commissioner, we have not had additional specific mitigation for those developers in Seminole County. It does seem that this is an isolated circumstance, because I've heard a lot about Hillsborough County, maybe another county or two, but the vast majority of counties in this state, concurrency as it exists today and what we're doing today with the concurrency service areas are working. And again, I want to remind everyone about there is law in Florida law about time, transportation maximum times. One is, I think, elementary is 50 minutes. And it's in middle and high school is 60 minutes. You have to be very careful, sensitive to that. I don't have to bring up the word busing. That has negative implications for everyone and costs when you're talking about additional busing. But most importantly, it's the quality of the education for the individual student. And I recall many studies that the number one issue for success in school, number one,
is a dedicated, concerned parent. But number two is small neighborhood schools. And so it's extremely important that the more that we do, as we look at this issue, the smaller the conservancy area we can keep. And at the same time, and you know, we're a growing county. We're growing, you know, leaps and bounds. We're dealing with it. And we're dealing with it from, you know, getting seven cities and a school board and a county to work together. And I think that you would find that if you sit down with the cities, with the county, and work it out, a district-wide, you tell a parent that they buy in a neighborhood, but they're going to have to send their child to four elementary schools down the road, I don't want to deal with that parent. And I've seen some parents that have come in even when they had to go to the next school down and were very upset. So the less we can do that, the keeping it in mind that neighborhood schools, both at the elementary, the middle, and the high school, is the most, you know, important thing that we can do to keep our parents happy. We need to do that.
Members, any questions? Rep. Maggard.
Thank you. Mine's a little off of concurrency, but I've been hearing costs the whole time. So I wouldn't mind asking a question to Superintendent Forson. What's it cost to build a high school for you?
You're recognized.
Yeah, we just built a 2,100 student high school, and total cost, I don't have the exact number, so don't quote me on it, but it is in range of, it's a $70 million project to do that in today's world.
Can I have a follow-up? Thank you. I would assume, based on the law, that it has to be hurricane protected to build that, correct?
You recognize?
Yeah, yes, sir, they do. And in fact, it's again when you work with the county, because you work with your county emergency management and making sure that you have adequate sheltering within the county. So for us, as we continue to grow, part of that cost, though, does reimburse back to us, because when we're playing additional for some areas of the school that we are hardening for hurricanes, our county's worked great with us to allow us to move forward with those projects, design it from day one that way, and then get reimbursement for some of those additional costs.
All right, thank you.
Rep. Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In my district, each year there are more and more building permits that are given. And we have had instances where we have a school that's approved, it's constructed, and the very day that it opens, it is over capacity. And you have to bring in portables. And I'd like to know, it sounds like you're working with your county commissioners, your permitting and building people, but what do we do in terms of a formula that will prevent that kind of overcapacity from occurring?
Ms. Usher?
Good question, Representative Thompson. We just opened three new schools this year, and we do not load the schools at 100%. When we're doing boundary change, we work with our attendance boundary committee, and we load the school at about 75%, because we don't know, we have the new school effect. People from charter school might be coming back, and we don't want to put portables there. So we have a regulation at staff that we load at 75%, and all of them open below capacity. So that's the kind of rule of thumb that we do in Polk County, so that we don't have to put portables.
Follow up.
Thank you. Is this something that's standard for all of the counties? Because apparently it's not happening in terms of projecting 75% and then accounting for additional growth.
It's on the school board level. So our school board knows that I'm doing that, and they're okay with us loading at that time to allow for growth without adding portables.
Thank you.
If I can.
Senator.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just want to, Representative Thompson, the school board has no authority to approve or deny proposed developments, but we have no authority to establish school attendance zones. So
what the question you're asking is really a question of individual school districts.
Any other questions? All right, here we go. One question I have, and this is for anybody on the panel. So can there be a difference in projections for student generation? Is there a process where the school district says, hey, we're going to have the need for X amount of stations over the next 10-year period, and the development community says, that seems awfully high? Yes. Is there a process? Can you explain that, Mr. Cimento?
Yeah, well, I think there's multiple formulas that different districts use, so that might be something that would help.
But is it challengeable? Is there a challenging process?
Yes.
In fact, can you explain that process?
Certainly. In our jurisdiction, we're in conversations with both the school district and the county commission, who will adopt the new impact fee ordinance under the interlocal agreement. And then what we're talking about right now is, if we can't come to a compromise, our HBA will file an action against both the school district and the Flagler County Commission. That's the only option available under the statute to challenge the impact fee ordinance that they passed.
So the only remedy, the only remedy is court action?
Yes, sir.
So if you have a school district that is developing their school concurrency plan and they say over the next 10 years we're going to need X amount of stations, that we need to charge X amount of dollars yielding X amount of total dollars, There's no process where the building community can say, that seems awfully high in terms of number of stations, where you can't go out, and the reason why I'm asking is because maybe this is something that we can consider, where the building community goes out and hires their own consultant, because they're obviously getting the stations from a consultant.
I'll give you what we've done.
And then go to some sort of mediation and then try to hammer it out.
I'm not aware of, under our interlocal agreement that establishes the concurrency management program, that there's a process that private sector can challenge without filing an action. Maybe you would, as a board attorney?
What I would say is that we're talking about, we're again mixing apples and oranges of impact fees and how the impact fees are calculated and how concurrency is evaluated. So for purposes of the five-year plan that most districts have, they usually plug in what schools they're going to build in the five-year plan based on that localized data that they were speaking about. However, when you come to an impact fee, most impact fees are done on what's called a consumption base. So how much does it cost to build a school? So it's not really based on population projections. It's not tied to that five-year plan necessarily. It somewhat is, but they're disconnected. And so in terms of the five-year plan, if the school board comes up with a five-year plan and it doesn't have, there's very difficult for the development community to know whether that five-year plan that the school board's putting out for their capital improvement projects are adequate to ensure that there's capacity available. We have to rely on the school board for that data. The issue of impact fees and thinking an impact fee is too high because we're not really generating students is a separate issue.
Ms. Usher, did you want to weigh in on that?
Our five-year plan, it's quite transparent. We work with the planning work group. We use our impact fees. It's a balance. We know how much we're getting every year. So we have, for example, we have schools in 22, 23 that we're already working on. And I make sure I get from the county all of our impact fees. We don't hold back our impact fees because the developers are paying that, so we have to give them the capacity. And that's why we're in such a schedule in building new capacity to keep pace. And our plan is transparent. We have a planning working group. They review our capital plan. We look at where growth is going, the need for new students, and we put those schools in and make sure that we'll have the money to fund those schools.
So that's a good segue into my next question. Mr. Cimento, I want to ask you a question about the amount of money that you said that Flagler has collected. What was that dollar amount?
It's roughly $27.8 million that they have told the county commission at the last meeting.
And is that all concurrency / impact / new capacity?
To the best of my knowledge, that is impact fees collected over the last 12 years. Remember, they have not constructed a school since 2012, I believe. So they have roughly 30,000, and they'll get about 7 million every year, roughly, based on their projection.
So the question I have is, how do they have that much money when they're supposed to have in their capital improvement plan, which is supposed to be 5 years or so? How are they not using that money to build the new capacity? Because then if they're not building, the question is, why did they collect it in the first place? And if they did collect it, why are they not expending it in the next place?
Well,
how did they get to that position where they have that much of a fund balance? Where I believe if it's not in there, is it in there? So this question, is it in their capital improvement plan at new capacity in there, in it, or is it just not in the capital improvement plan at all?
To the best of my knowledge, in October was the first time they added capacity programs in a significant period of time. They just put in their expansion programs.
So the question really asks is, why were they even collecting it in the first place if they didn't have it in there?
That is what our Home Builders Association is discussing and asking.
But isn't the remedy under current law, and forgive me, I'm not an attorney, to refund the money if it's not expended within a certain amount of time?
The statute does reference something to that. Okay. Within a reasonable time, I believe, is the words used.
Mr. Chair, it does.
Senator? Yes.
It does. And but remember, $30 million wouldn't pay for an elementary school, and a single elementary school. It's about $30, $35 million for an elementary school. And I'm not taking either side here. You know, I'm in the middle. I listen, get information, and try to, you know, work with the development community. And we think we've found a happy medium. But like someone said in the panel, you know, talking about concurrency and talking about impact fees are two different things. I mean, what household in Flagler is going to generate as a child is far different than what Seminole County is going to, you know, generate as a child. You know, you look at it, every single apartment, every single home, there's going to be a much larger student population individual than it would be in mm-hmm. Flagler. Just look at the demographics. And that's why, again, one size doesn't fit all. And it's the same thing with impact fees. You mentioned, and you are absolutely right, when we do anything in impact fees, when the school board in Seminole County does anything, remember, we have to approve those impact fees from the school board. We make sure that they have talked to the Apartment Association, AAGO, that they have talked to the Home Builders Association, they have talked to every single group, worked with them. And I will tell you that in both senses, with the impact fees as well as concurrency, the Home Builders Association and the AAGO, Apartment Association of Greater Orlando, came back in support of the numbers that we were putting out and working together with them. So it's a question of how, each one does it. And to say, you know, to sit there and try to come up with a single rule on concurrency, I think would be a major mistake.
But you would agree that at least and I can see the flexibility because each district has different needs and they need to be able to adjust to those needs. But I think you would agree, and if you have any ideas, I'd be more than happy to listen to that, way we can make it more transparent.
Thank you, sir. At one point, Flagler was the fastest growing county in the nation, I believe. And you know, just by sheer numbers, they were going to have more children. So I think that, you know, circumstances change also all the time. So you have to take that flexibility into effect. You know, I think that I can remember in when I was in the legislature, the biggest problem was portables. I mean, we were just being inundated with parents saying, get rid of these portables. And we did a special allocation in the general revenue to ensure that we could boost up the education dollars so that we could get rid of portables, and required that they had to get rid of portables. So the fact of the matter right now is requiring a district-wide, I think, is not the answer. I think more likely is making sure that the development community, along with the cities and the county and the school district, gets together and works out what capacity and what concurrency is needed. And I think that, without question, I'm a major supporter of transparency. They have to know the numbers. It is a snapshot in time that is required. It's not something that the school board does because they want to. It's something that they have to. You can only, you know, set up at one particular time, taking into consideration charter schools and taking into consideration private schools is very important also. We have a large private school in Seminole County also. But the fact of the matter is that the answer, one size fits all, doing it at district level is, I think, the wrong answer and would cause unintended consequences that you haven't even thought of, or I haven't even thought of at this time.
So we have, Mr. Forson, go ahead.
Yeah, if I can address a couple of things, because I think it was mentioned early on, is that it can't be one size fits all. So just give you an example for us. We're blessed in a lot of ways. So when I say we extract charters, we only have three charter schools in St. John's. Two of them are special needs charters, very low population, and the other is a Montessori. So really, it's an insignificant number and impact to what decisions we would be making from that area. The adjacency piece is important in the fact that if the CSAs get too large, something that was shared early on, it absolutely will move children away from their neighborhood and away from their area or region of the county, which is really harmful, I think, in many ways. And it is there is some truth about there's it's factual about transportation being an issue where you've got to get them. And they deserve to be transported to a place in a timely manner, and that becomes a little bit of an issue. The other piece I will say that we're very blessed with is, you know, I know that some counties have 15, 20 municipalities. So in St. John's, we have two. So we're very fortunate in that the conversations between the county, between the school district, and between those municipalities is regular. And it's positive in many ways. The last piece on projecting numbers, every school district does a five-year work plan. That five-year work plan is based on projections that first come from the state, from DOE, from the Office of Educational Facilities, where they are looking at what is the trend of growth. And so you work with a couple of models that they provide you with to determine those projections, which then allow you, very honestly, many times we're trying to move projects into that window of time so that it creates capacity, so that it does, so when projects move forward, it happens. The flip side is not for us. It's not that we are over-projecting. I'll give you two schools, the last two schools we built, K-8 schools. They were built for 1,500 students. They're 3 years old. One of them right now sits at 2,300 students. 2,300 students that has a capacity for 1,500. The second one, we already built another K-8 to relieve it because it was at 23 in year two of the school. It is a piece that for us, and it's unique. So for St. John's, we lease relocatables. We lease portables because it's that fast that when you build a new school, if you build it, they will come. The houses will be built in that area. They will buy them. They will be in there. We need to add the relocatables to serve the kids. I would say it's different than other infrastructures in that we don't have a choice as to whether or not we serve the child. The family comes, we serve them. So we have to do whatever it happens to be. And for us, I would say in many cases, in spots in our county, it's not over-projecting. It's the fact that it gets very specific and runs past us if we're not careful.
Quick question for you, and anybody can weigh in on the panel on this question. Is it common, or have you heard instances of people collecting imposing school concurrency on an area, but then taking that money or that mitigation and using it in other areas for other schools, or is it all being used in that particular area?
Really, you're not supposed to. You cannot. I mean, that school concurrency money is tied.
We have those arguments with impact fees all the time. We have counties collecting impact fees in one area.
And using it for other purposes? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Yes, sir.
That's why the question. Sorry. So, Ms. Corbett?
Chair, if I could. In Hillsborough County, we have a district-wide impact fee, but we still retain concurrency service areas. So everyone pays the same fee, and because everyone pays the same fee, they utilize it to build schools all over the county.
So you can, So you can have an overpopulated area in a concurrency zone and an underpopulated area, overpopulated by 20%, underpopulated by 40%, but they're still assessing it countywide?
Everybody's paying the same fee. That was based upon the methodology.
Polk has the same? So can you rationalize how does that work? Why does that work? Why should it work? Because it seems a little odd.
It works based on good planning. It's a countywide. Some counties have zones for impact fees. Polk is countywide. And so it's really, it helps because we can put all our money from the entire county into the area where we need it right away to build that school. So it's all part of planning and the need for capacity. So having it countywide, we collect impact fees countywide, but we focus it in the Northeast because we need the capacity there now. Not that that other area where the impact fee is coming from won't get a school, but it helps us in prioritizing and putting all our money into the area where it's needed. And again, concurrency service area is on the attendance boundary, but impact fees on district-wide, I believe, is beneficial to us building schools where they're needed.
Okay, so the question then comes up is, it's obvious from how you're describing it that you guys are a little bit on top of the situation. You're thinking ahead. You're thinking proactively. But in areas where you have counties that are not thinking ahead, not thinking proactively, and are always behind the eight ball and are always trying to catch up, or they're mismanaging it, could you see how that could be a problem where they're collecting concurrency applying concurrency to one area and then charging the developer a lot in terms of cost or mitigation and then shifting it somewhere else, and the developer's like, why am I paying for your mistakes?
Okay, we're talking impact fees or
concurrency.
Okay, concurrency, nobody ever had to mitigate. I was talking impact fees and using the money countywide to build a school where it is needed. So we never had the developer mitigate, but I would think that if a developer had to mitigate because there's no capacity in that area, then it would have to stay in that area. But with impact fees, if it's district-wide, it can go into building that school. And again, the state has a lot of regulations. We have to submit a balanced capital plan that shows that we're accounting for the growth. And I don't know if all districts are doing that and how we'll fund it.
Okay, so we have, to the left of me, we have government. To the right, we have the private sector is trying to deal with this. I want to go down the line, and this will be the last question I have. Is there something you can offer to the committee that will help through this process of school concurrency, something that you guys are either doing, best practices that you think would help, that's not necessarily in the law, but it's best practices, it's common sense that you guys are doing to help the issue? And then on this side, is there something you can offer us of things that you would like to be seen done that you think that would help the development side when it comes to this? So we'll start with you, Mr. Forson.
Thank you. I think for us, I feel good about where we are and what we are doing. The fact of the things, if I say help, it is it's growth beyond control in that sense that we've had this great influx of families. I like it as it is and utilizing. It's part of a fairly comprehensive capital funding program in St. John's County because we do have a half-cent sales tax, we have impact fees, and then we have school concurrency. And so when you take that with the limited $1.5 mil property tax that's in that, then when you combine those together, we're able to do as much as we can, as fast as we can. So I really am probably more all about protecting what is there rather than changing it to something else. I think if there's one thing that I've learned from listening to this is greater transparency to the process would be helpful for everyone.
Ms. Usher.
Working closely with the local government. For example, we try to buy sites ahead of time. And so the school, the county or the local government help us with our site selection. And they know, they tell us if there's water or sewer, they tell us about any of their infrastructure plan. So we do have the school site. So when we need the school, we don't have to put impact fees out to buy that. We can just go ahead and start building the school right away. We also have, like, we have an attendance boundary committee. We have a county representative on that committee also. And we have planners on that committee that can help us with our demography and our population breakdown. It's just talking to them, having those planning meetings, sharing our capital plans with them to make sure that we have enough capacity to serve the development. If development continues, then we'll have more impact fees. We'll be able to build more schools. If it slows down, our impact fees will decrease. And so we'll plan accordingly. So that's it for
Polk County School District. I want to thank you for putting this together because I think there's been a lot of information and there's more that people agree with and disagree, I think. You know, I'm not just a county commissioner person that used to be a legislator. I've made all my money, most of my money, as a developer. And so I have sympathy when, you know, when you're talking about the development interests and everything. But the fact of the matter is that I've heard one, maybe two counties that have a problem. I will tell you that if you made, and I'm going to specifically discuss district-wide, you made it district-wide, you'll have 67 problems, the 67 counties, because school districts will not move a person from the east side all the way for the west side. Just think of Polk County or the north down to the south or whatever. They will shift everyone, you know, and do rezoning, and there is nothing more contentious ever than rezoning a school district. It disrupts families, it disrupts neighborhoods, and it disrupts education. Because the number one thing that we're looking for here is how we can deliver education better for all. So if I gave you any suggestion, I'd look at the five counties that are A district counties in the state and what they're doing. And those five counties are St. John's, Seminole, Okaloosa, Clay, and Sarasota. And those are the counties that are delivering school district, delivering education in a way. Now, there's a lot that has to do with the citizens and the demographics, yes. But a lot of it also has to do with the way that they're delivering and how they're working with all sides in doing this. So making one size, and we said it a number of times, making one size fits all is not the answer to this concern.
Ms. Corbett?
Chair, and just while I also represent developers, I do also represent school boards. So I just want to make that part clear, and I think that there are some that do it very well. The three that are here today sound like they're planning and preparing and they're doing what they need to do. And going back to my earlier remarks, the one thing that I do think that could be done is when you have a situation where you have two government entities that are not functioning well together for whatever reason, whether it's the school board or whether it's the county, and they can't do what it is they need to do to adopt that unified vision for providing school concurrency, that you allow the development community to pay their impact fees, pay any mitigation that might be necessary, and continue to develop.
Mr. Dunn?
Along the same lines, I understand where concurrency came from, and it's been around a long time, and I think as circumstances change, I think laws need to be reexamined. And I agree with Ms. Corbett. I think we've got some great examples of jurisdictions that are functioning properly. I tend to work in one that's not functioning as well, but I think there's also a lot of in between. And I'll really wrap up with just an anecdote that about 15 years ago, I worked for a large national home building company, and I was selected as the person to train the new president of Florida on concurrency and impact fees and how it all worked here. The guy couldn't get it because it's just so complicated. And it's the answer was always, well, sort of, or not everywhere. And, when you talk about concurrency and impact fees, I mean, that's a really circular subject. And I just really wonder if concurrency hasn't outlived itself. And, shouldn't we just have a fair impact fee and empower the local governments to deliver the schools. I think that's really what we're all after, high quality schools, and there just seems to be this excessive regulation around, you know, measuring capacity and trying to boil it down to a formula. The world's just become too dynamic for that. If anything, we've certainly seen that in the last 2 years.
Mr. Schimento.
That was an excellent point. I agree with it. I think there's an argument with what Mr. Nunn said, and I was prepared to talk about it, that concurrency has outlived it, and it may not be necessary. Correct me if I'm mistaken, Mr. Constantine, but you all haven't charged a mitigation concurrency payment, and yet they are an extremely fast-growing dynamic. So that would almost support the argument or the notion that concurrency is not necessary in order to ensure schools, quality schools, are delivered in a timely manner. Because these layers that you've heard today make more and more complexity. I don't know why a developer needs to be concerned and to evaluate service areas and school capacity and why a school has lost capacity in order to defend their position. My clients may hit me for saying this, but I would assert that probably many of my clients would pay a little bit more under a pay-and-go theory. Pay-and-go, and let the professionals, the school districts, and the local governments decide how to deliver those services rather than drag the developers in to have to figure this out. So I'd say that there's an argument. I think your statute even suggests that these jurisdictions may adopt. Isn't that correct? They may adopt concurrency management programs. So it's already been contemplated that you don't have to. But if they do, if you do keep concurrency and the mitigation, I think there needs to be some consistency on formula and how mitigation is charged. And maybe the DOE might be best suited to help us on that because they receive information from all the jurisdictions. So those would be my comments. And the last thing that I think many statutes that we have in there is your statute doesn't have a process to allow a developer to appeal. The difference between paying $1.6 million up front and $600,000 up front, which is a project that I'm working on, is significant, but there's no process. Until we get that resolved, my clients are stuck. Maybe you could post a bond, maybe there's an appeal process. Nobody projects that you don't have to pay it, but there's no process to question it in this time frame of capital and banking and financing and delivering services.
I want to thank you and everybody. We have to wrap this up. I want to thank all the members of the panel for taking their time indulging me with the questions and having a discussion about school concurrency. So thank you again. If there are no further business, Rep. McClure moves to adjourn without objection. The motion passes, and we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.